Universe of Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The U.S. Monday accused Syria of carrying out mass killings of prisoners and burning their bodies in a large crematorium. Acting Assistant Secretary of State Stuart Jones said dozens are being hanged at the Saidnaya prison every day.
Beginning in 2013, the Syrian regime modified a building within the Saidnaya complex to support what we believe is a crematorium. Although the regime's many atrocities are well documented, we believe that the building of a crematorium is an effort to cover up the extent of mass murders taking place in Saidnaya prison.
He said the regime of Bashar al-Assad has, quote, sunk to a new level of depravity, apparently with unconditional support of Russia and Iran. Anthony Billingsley, senior Mideast lecturer at the University of New South Wales in Australia, said the rights group Amnesty International issued a similar report in February.
The idea of a crematorium, of course, has dreadful connotations for those with a memory. The idea of massacres in prisons, there was one in Iran, there was one in Libya. It doesn't surprise, and I suspect that the US and Amnesty, who previously reported on this, have reasonably good intelligence about this facility.
The U.S. report came a day after a resumption of the latest Geneva peace talks on Syria. Previous rounds have produced little or no progress. And the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says airstrikes, possibly involving U.S.-led coalition aircraft, struck an Islamic State-controlled town in Deir ez-Zor, killing and wounding dozens. It was revealed Monday that Nigerian herdsmen armed with guns killed at least 20 farmers and wounded several over the weekend in the west central Niger state. The farmers were attacked while taking part in prayers at a local mosque. This is VOA News. The White House has denied a published report that President Donald Trump last week disclosed highly classified information to two high-ranking Russian officials provided by a third party about an operation against Islamic State. The Washington Post quoted two U.S. officials who it said had knowledge of the meeting. National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster dismissed the report as false.
The president and the foreign minister reviewed a range of common threats to our two countries, including threats to civil aviation. At no time were intelligence sources or methods discussed, and the president did not disclose any military operations that were not already publicly known.
McMaster said he and Secretary of State Rex Tillerson were in the room and the reported discussion did not take place. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan visits Mr. Trump at the White House Tuesday. The Turkish leader said it could mark a new beginning in easing strained ties. He suggested the recent U.S. decision to arm YPG Kurdish rebels in Syria may have resulted from a policy carried over from the previous Obama administration. Just a week before Mr. Trump's visit, Israeli officials are said to be shocked after a U.S. official reportedly told them the Western Wall, Judaism's holiest shrine, is in the West Bank and, quote, not your territory. The unnamed official is also said to have turned down a request that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu accompany Mr. Trump at the wall. University of South Carolina analyst Joseph Olmert said the controversy came at a sensitive time.
Recently, the UNESCO accepted resolutions which deny any connection between the Jews and their holiest places in Jerusalem. I mean, this is stupid, of course, anti-Semitic, but that caused a lot of stir in Israel and enhanced altogether nationalist feelings in Israel, as you can imagine.
The controversy occurred on the same day new U.S. Ambassador to Israel David Friedman took up his post. His first stop was prayer at the Western Wall. French President Emmanuel Macron spent his first full day in office Monday meeting German Chancellor Angela Merkel in Berlin.
Il y a la nécessité d'avoir une Europe.
He said there is a need to have a Europe that is less bureaucratic. He called for a greater European pragmatism. Mr. Macron was inaugurated on Sunday. The International Committee of the Red Cross Monday said that a cholera outbreak in Yemen has killed nearly 200 people since late April. Rajak Medhok is with the UN Children's Agency.
With over 8,500 cases of suspected diarrhea across the country, Yemen is yet again staring at a public health crisis.
The rebels who control the capital, Sana'a, have declared a state of emergency. Hundreds of heavily armed Christian anti-Balaka militia in the city of Bangassou in Central African Republic have reportedly agreed to withdraw after launching an attack on Muslims that killed at least one UN peacekeeper and several civilians. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate, Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 16th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Rebel soldiers in Ivory Coast have rejected a settlement proposal as their rebellion spreads to other major cities.
Actually, it's really spreading from Bouaké and is now in Abidjan. But not only in Abidjan, in other towns like San Pedro, where there is the second half of the country, in Daloa, which is the third town, in Gagnoa.
Jean-Guevé Tchéidé is a member of the opposition Ivorian Popular Front Party. Food shortages raise tensions among Nigerian refugees and local communities in northern Cameroon. A new South Sudan political coalition wants to rescue the country from collapse. And the DRC government says a small Ebola outbreak in a remote region of the country has been brought under control.
We have learned from our partners of WHO that the situation is well contained by our doctors.
Lamba Mende is Information Minister of the Democratic Republic of Congo. A South African court hears arguments on an upcoming parliamentary vote of no confidence in President Zuma. And a new study outlines strategies for containing the spread of Ebola. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Rebel soldiers in Ivory Coast have rejected a settlement proposal as their rebellion spreads to other major cities of the country. The mutinous soldiers, who fought to overthrow President Laurent Gbagbo, have been demanding $20,000 each that they say President Alassane Ouattara promised to pay them. The government has offered to pay a little over $8,300 each by today, Tuesday. But the mutinous soldiers rejected the offer, saying they want about $12,000 initial payment. Meanwhile, the rebellion has spread from the second largest city of Bouaké to four other cities, including the commercial capital Abidjan, San Pedro, Daloa, and Gagnoa. Jean-Guevé Tchéidé is a member of a former president Laurent Gbagbo's Ivorian Popular Front Party. He says there was gunfire last night in Abidjan.
Actually, it's really spreading from Bouaké, and it is now in Abidjan. But not only in Abidjan, in other towns like San Pedro, where there is a second half of the country, in Daloa, which is a third town, in Gagnoa, the hometown of the former president, Mr. Laurent Gbagbo. And so on and so forth. Many cities inside the country are experiencing this mutiny. So I can tell you that the biggest military camp in Abidjan is under the control of those mutineers. In the morning, they spread all over the area, blocking the roads and preventing people from going to work, and everybody stayed at home. Today, there was no work in Abidjan. The central area of the city, which we call Plateau, nobody went to work. At midday, the government gave a communique to tell people to stay at home because the situation is dangerous. So all day long, yesterday, nobody went to work. Actually, the situation was really, really tense and dangerous. We stayed indoors.
The defense minister said that the army had talked with the mutinous soldiers and that they had reached some kind of an arrangement to end the crisis.
Yeah, that is the second time the government is making such a statement to say that they came to an agreement with the soldiers, but unfortunately, even this second agreement is not accepted, seems not to have been accepted by the mutineers, because the firing continued last night and even in the night. So this statement seems to be something which has not been really discussed with the real mutineers, because there is a problem.
The mutinous soldiers are saying they have rejected an offer that was made to them by the government, apparently about the amount of money that is supposed to be paid to them. What do you know about that?
Well, I don't have the paper of the so-called agreement, but we hear that the government, out of the 7 million mutineers which was claimed, the government is proposing 2 or 3 million right now and the rest later on, which the mutineers seem to have refused. But once again, I must say that I have no evidence of that agreement Nobody, not even the Ministry of Defense, gave any inch about it. So we don't know the real content of this agreement.
I know the mutinous soldiers have said that their purpose is not to overthrow the government, but one must say that there continues to be this disunity ever since the election.
Yeah, well, they keep saying that they have no intention of overthrowing the government. But what we can see is that they are tending towards it, because if you are claiming only your money, you cannot try to reach the national television, you cannot try to reach the television in Bouaké, because when mutineers or soldiers catch television in Africa, it is just to make an announcement of a coup. So we are waiting, because if they continue saying that they have no intention of a putsch, this is okay, but unfortunately, we seem to be heading to that.
Thank you for giving us this update from Abidjan. Thank you very much.
You are welcome.
Jean-Gervais Tchéide is a member of former President Laurent Gbagbo's Ivorian Popular Front Party. He was speaking with me from the Ivorian commercial capital, Abidjan. The Democratic Republic of Congo's government says a small Ebola outbreak in a remote region of the country has been brought under control. The World Health Organization says the outbreak occurred in Likati County, about 1,300 kilometers from the capital, Kinshasa. The first Ebola outbreak in Africa happened in the DRC, and since then, the country has experienced the disease 8 different times. Information Minister Lambert Mende says his country does not panic anymore about Ebola because it has trained enough doctors to deal with the disease.
We were informed about this disease that happened in the Akiti County, probably 2,000 kilometers from Kinshasa. And we have deployed teams of medical doctors with the assistance of World Health Organization. They went there and they took all measures necessary to contain the disease. And today we have learned from our partners of WHO that the situation is well contained by our doctors.
So, Minister, does your government know the origin of the disease so far?
As we are talking, we can't say from where it originates, but it is a village very near the border of Central African Republic. We are still inquiring to know what happened, because there is a lot of refugees there. So we are still waiting a report from the health ministry.
This is not the first time, Minister, that your country has encountered Ebola. Do you find that your country is more prepared to deal with this disease?
Let me tell you that the first time Ebola happened in the world, it was here in Congo. And Ebola is the name of a river here in Congo. And we experienced the disease 8 times. That is why I can tell you that today we are among the few countries who are well prepared to deal with it, because we have trained a lot of physicians to deal with this disease. So we can't be panicking about it.
Minister, I wanted to see if you can give me a comment. The East has killed 390 fighters. Is your military involved in some kind of operation to put down the unrest in the East, in Kasai?
In Kasai, we are facing a terrorist offensive, and the army have been deployed there to destroy that terrorist. That is our duty, and we shall do it up to the end, until all of them will surrender. We can't give up. We can't leave our people at the hands of terrorists. That is the situation in Kasai province.
The president named a new government recently. So where are things now? Do you find there's movement in the implementation of the December 31st agreement?
The government will be presented tomorrow to the National Assembly. And if the members of a parliament accept it, it will be given the right to start working. So this is the provision of the Constitution. So we are waiting tomorrow the decision from the National Assembly, the parliament. That is what is written in our constitution. And the president did everything that is written in the constitution as well as in the 31st December agreement. So we are going ahead for the elections at the end of this year.
Lamba Mende is the Information Minister of the Democratic Republic of Congo. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kinshasa. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 16th. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. A new study outlining containment strategies for Ebola may help prevent an epidemic similar to the one that engulfed a number of West African countries 2 years ago. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
The report on measures to curtail the spread of the aggressive Ebola virus is timely. There are now three confirmed Ebola deaths in the DRC. Public health officials are reportedly investigating a total of 9 suspicious cases of the deadly viral infection. During the epidemic of 2014-2015, more than 28,000 people became infected, and more than 11,000 in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone died. In the study published in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, an international team of researchers culled 37 studies for the most effective containment strategies. Katrina Shea is a professor of biology at Pennsylvania State University and co-author of the study.
The best strategies that we found out of the 5 that we looked at were funeral containment and public information campaigns of sort of care in the community.
Ebola virus is spread through contact with the bodily fluids of infected individuals. Shea says investigators found the number one way to prevent transmission of Ebola was for loved ones to avoid washing bodies of the deceased prior to burial. Shea says that information is best conveyed through public health campaigns that also stress the importance of hand washing, personal hygiene, and self-quarantine in high transmission areas. People suspected of being infected with Ebola, the report found, should also not hesitate to go to the hospital or clinic for evaluation and treatment. But researchers found building more hospitals in response to an epidemic to be the least effective way to prevent the spread of Ebola within communities. Investigators undertook the study in response to the public health emergency 2 years ago. At the height of the epidemic, Shea says there was no consensus on the best ways to contain the Ebola epidemic, and that's why researchers decided to look into the matter.
We really wanted to try to do something. You know, many of us have children and were moved by stories of individual horrors and so forth. And others of us felt that perhaps something we did scientifically might contribute to making future outbreaks less horrific.
With the virus once again threatening to become a public health menace, Shea says it's not too early to begin taking aggressive measures to prevent another Ebola epidemic. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Food shortages in northern Cameroon are raising tensions between local communities and Nigerian refugees displaced by the Boko Haram conflict. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Minawao in northern Cameroon.
A quarrel erupts between hawkers at the food market near the Minawao refugee camp as 17-year-old Paul Sibani accuses a Nigerian refugee of stealing his money.
Si tu as vraiment raison que tu es un coupable, on laisse le coupable et on te prend.
He says he chooses to settle the issue himself because he says the police are biased in favor of refugees. At the local police post, officers said they were not authorized to comment, but they added disputes between refugees and local residents are growing more common. UN aid agencies have been carrying out activities to sensitize refugees and host communities and to promote peaceful conflict resolution, but tensions remain. Jenabu Jani cleans her goats in Aramba village, 6 kilometers from the refugee camp. She says she has lost 6 of them in the past month. She suspects refugees who visit a nearby stream for water. She says local authorities have not pursued the villagers' complaints. She says they have decided to beat any refugees caught stealing. Meanwhile, the refugees say they are struggling and local water and food resources are stretched thin. The Minawawa camp and surrounding communities are home to about 75,000 Nigerians who fled Boko Haram violence. The conflict split over into northern Cameroon more than 2 years ago. The insecurity has hurt farming and trade. In January, funding shortfalls forced the UN World Food Programme to cut rations for refugees at Minawawa by 25%. UN staff told VOA the reduced rations are expected to continue until new funding arrives in June. Falmata Mustafa has lived at the camp with her four children since 2015.
Falmata Mustafa.
Okay, mama.
She tells VOA through an interpreter that after rations were cut, she decided to pull her two oldest children from school to send them to nearby wild bushes and farms to forage for food and water. She says they are eating just one meal a day and they are very hungry. Aid workers and educators at Minawawa camp say they have seen as much as a 50% drop in school attendance.
What is this?
Nigerian-born teacher Musa Lava leads his form 3 class in their lesson.
They don't participate in the class because they face some problems like lack of clothes, lack of something to satisfy their need at home. You can see children 40 in the class today. Tomorrow you will see them 20 or 15 only. And that one is a challenge to the teacher. And I will not feel comfortable to teach them since the children are not coming always.
The government says just one-third of the $690 million needed to meet the needs of displaced people and host communities this year has been received. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News in Minawawa, Cameroon.
South Africa's Constitutional Court heard arguments yesterday on whether the upcoming parliamentary vote of no confidence against President Jacob Zuma should be a secret ballot. The court's ruling could have political consequences. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
Lawyers representing the opposition parties argued in favor of their petition before a full bench of the Constitutional Court in Johannesburg. Geoff Butlender is a legal representative of the opposition.
The core submission is that the function of the court is to create the conditions in which members of the National Assembly can carry out their constitutional duty of oversight, and that the only way to create that condition is to allow a secret ballot. The fear is that if there's an open ballot, you will be expelled from the party and expelled from Parliament through that mechanism. That's why there needs to be a secret ballot.
Lawyers representing President Jacob Zuma and the Speaker of Parliament countered that no confidence votes have never taken place in secret. They argued the Constitution does not allow the courts to tell Parliament how to conduct its business. Outside the court, members of other opposition parties, civil society organizations, and religious groups demonstrated in support of a secret ballot. Zuma has faced mounting criticism following several corruption scandals in the past year and a controversial cabinet reorganization last month. Members of his ruling coalition have been among those calling on him to step down. While the questions before the Constitutional Court are legal, the stakes are highly political. The opposition needs to garner a two-thirds majority in Parliament to vote Zuma out. To get it, the opposition would need some ANC lawmakers to break ranks. The ruling African National Congress has already instructed its MPs to back Zuma. Speaking to reporters last month, ANC Secretary General Gwetaman Tasha said a secret ballot will not change the way the ANC lawmakers vote.
There will be no ANC member who will vote in either way for a motion of the opposition. We are members of the ANC in a party political system and we will not vote against the ANC.
Once the court delivers its judgment on how the vote can be conducted, Parliament is expected to set a date to consider the motion of no confidence. Zuma's second elected mandate does not expire until 2019. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
A new opposition coalition in South Sudan says it wants to rescue the country from collapse. The new group, which calls itself Political Opposition Forces, comprises armed and unarmed South Sudanese. Pagan Amung, who signed the last peace deal on behalf of the former detainees, says the coalition is working to organize a meeting for all opposition groups to join hands and bring peace to South Sudan.
The situation is very dangerous. The country needs to be rescued as soon as people can. That is why the opposition forces are coming together to unite their efforts and come together with a clear vision and a clear program of how to rescue the country. Also to mobilize the region, the continent, and the international community to come to the rescue of our country because the peace agreement has collapsed.
What plans is this new united opposition having for the people of South Sudan?
The first step is for the opposition to come together and develop through consensus a clear rescue plan for the country. And we believe the elements of this plan would be one, to push for a new inclusive political process, to push for a roundtable bringing together all the stakeholders, all the South Sudanese stakeholders, whether the political forces or the armed groups, the civil society, the church leadership.
Do you have any timeline as to when the meeting will actually take place?
We are engaging a number of countries in the region, and we are very hopeful that this will be happening. I am not able to specifically talk about a specific country, but we are engaging all our countries in the region, our neighbors, who are concerned for us.
Who is leading this new coalition?
I'm sure it is going to be a collective leadership, and that the formalization of that will come through the discussion that is being planned. The leaders have agreed to organize a face-to-face meeting. We have been meeting in the cyber world for a number of times. We are engaged continuously, almost on a daily basis. We are discussing all these issues, but we need to come together. And we will definitely agree on the modalities and the forms of this organization and how we will be working together.
Can you comment on the recent development in South Sudan where the former SPLA General Chief of Staff, General Paul Malong, was fired? He went to Yirol on his way to Awil. He came back.
Yirol and Malong were the people who introduced violence and instituted this hegemonic regime in Juba. And therefore, they were careful because if they were to start fighting each other, that would have been the end of the regime. So I believe it is that consideration that made them to opt for negotiating this thing and backing off from violent confrontation, which was about to take place.
There are lots of speculations in South Sudan. There's a lot of uncertainty in the air. If you're given a chance to speak directly to the South Sudanese, what would you tell them?
It is time to learn from our experience in the last few years from independence, and it is time to change our direction. It is time to stop this violence and this war. It is time to move away from tribalism and sectarianism.
That was Pagan Amung, a member of the former political detainees in South Sudan. He was speaking to John Tanza of VOA South Sudan in Focus program. And that's it for this Tuesday, May 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good day.
Hello, I'm Lina Ormudu, host of Health Chat. Do you have trouble sleeping? Well, join us this Tuesday as we take a look at sleep deprivation and how to address it with our guest, Dr. Ken Redcross, internal medicine specialist and concierge doctor. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-691-3111. Health Chat this Tuesday at 1730 UTC right here on VOA Africa.